Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters with your host, me, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. We are adding to our collection of amazing podcasts that are part of Pharmacy Times Pharmacy Focus podcast series. And I have another incredible guest with me here today, Amy from the Cupcake Girls. I don't know if you want me to call you Amy Marie, but I will do whatever you so desire, my dear. And I am just thrilled to bring this incredible human on the podcast because the first time I met you, your presence was just bigger than life. Like it was so electric. And the first thing I did, I turned over to my colleague that I worked with at the health department and I said, "Who is that? I need to meet that woman." That is legit the first thing I said. So without further ado, if you could just give us a quick intro and then we can dive into some questions. Yeah. I love to bring people on that may not necessarily be working in healthcare, but definitely healthcare adjacent. Yeah. And obviously the advocacy work that you do is so phenomenal that I just want to scream it from the rooftops. So Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself and the fact that you work for an organization called the Cupcake Girls, which sounds pretty awesome.
Thank you so much for this generous introduction. My name is Amy Marie Merrill. My pronouns are she, her, and I am the executive director of the Cupcake Girls. The Cupcake Girls is an organization that works in the prevention and aftercare of sex trafficking, which we'll get into during this podcast. But I've been working with sex workers and trafficking survivors for the last 17 years. And I've been working with the Cupcake Girls now for 11 years. A little bit more about me is that I am obsessed with my dog Luna and my daughter Lux. They are the literal sun and moons of my life, and I'm so thankful for them. And I really love living in sunny Las Vegas. It is gorgeous weather out here. We're in monsoon season. It's been pretty fun. I don't know how you've been with it, but I've been loving it. So that's a little bit about me. And I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. It's equal admiration, that's for sure. So excited to talk.
Yes. And I love the fact that you are such an incredible example for your daughter, especially because, you know, the work that both of us do, because we work with gender-based health and, you know, sexual health, that could be something that could be very, you know, depressing. But ultimately, you know, we choose to look at it differently and we choose to make the best of it and ultimately try to, you know, give an opportunity for those that are, you know, in the business, right? In the family, as they like to say, giving them an opportunity to live their fullest and their best lives. So with that being said, I would really like to, I know you said that you've been working with this community for the past 17 years, and then specifically with the Cupcake Girls for the last 11 years, but you within this like leadership position, that's actually fairly recent, right? Like within the last little bit. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about like how that evolution happened. I always like to hear people's like origin stories because, you know, this is not for the faint of heart. You know, I really do think that this is a calling because not everybody can feel comfortable talking about sex and sexuality. And even just, you know, hearing people's stories, if they did have a traumatic experience and having to deal with, you know, more trauma-informed care, which I tend to utilize just because I work very closely with the LGBTQIA plus community, but not everybody works in that space. And so if you can maybe just talk a little bit about that, I think that might be beneficial for the audience to hear.
Yeah, totally. So I got into this work at a pretty young age, actually. So like I said, 17 years. And my first experience working with folks in this industry was actually my first job. In my first job, I met a sex worker. I was working at a local bookstore in Oregon, and I had been homeschooled my entire life. And so between that and going to church was usually where I met my friends. And when I had this job at the bookstore and I came home to tell my parents, that our pastors, that, hey, I just made a friend at the bookstore and they are a sex worker. At that time, the term sex worker hadn't been coined quite yet. And so I said, she works in prostitution. And I just remember the color in my dad's face going from like,
oh my goodness, white. I can imagine. Oh my gosh. Yes. Like,
I actually
talk
got
about, like, why does a sheet, right?
Yeah, I just, I was 16 years old. And I think my dad and I were, we were just talking about this when I went home for a visit a couple weeks ago. And I was like, what did that feel like to you? And he said, I was just really concerned. I didn't know really what that was going to mean for you, for us moving forward. And what ended up happening was, as I built a relationship with this person, they told me their story of being assaulted by two police officers in our town. They had been rescued from a trafficking sting, and they ended up experiencing assault from two police officers in Eugene, Oregon. And as they were sharing more of their story, more people shared more of their story. There was actually 12 different folks, either sex workers or trafficking survivors, that came forward in Eugene. And they said, hey, we're being assaulted by these folks. And the two officers, Roger Manjana and Juan Francisco Lara, they were brought to justice by the way that our carceral system provides justice. They were brought into court, brought into prison, and they're serving time. But the after effects of that action and the after effects of everything that they had done, it's rippled into the lives of these people to this day. I mean, the fact that, you know, it causes a lot of fear. Can I trust the police department? And unfortunately, this isn't a one-time thing. We're seeing this all over the United States, where folks are taken into custody and unfortunately they're raped. And this is an issue that we're having all over our country, right? So that was my first experience with with sex workers. And then later on, I went on to be a flight attendant. And when I was a flight attendant, I would see lots of different things all over the United States. This is dating myself a little bit, but it's before the placards were on the inside of bathroom stalls, where you could say 1-800, you know, I need help.
Yep. Which I know that's, and they're all over now. They're not just in the bathrooms in this, right, in the airplanes. Now they're in the bathrooms in the stalls, in all of the restrooms in the airports, yep, too, because again, the trafficking is so prevalent.
Yep.
And it's one of those things that we just kind of turn a blind eye to.
100%. So a lot of the flight attendants, we would trade resources, and we would say, hey, in this city, there's this domestic violence shelter. In this city, there's this shelter for houselessness. In this city, you can call this number if you have somebody on your plane that's experiencing trafficking. And you mentioned calling earlier, and that is definitely how I feel about this work in my life, because it just felt like it kept coming in front of my face. It just kept, it felt like it wasn't leaving. And even when it was a little bit too much for me to handle, I was understanding that my privilege allowed me to step away from it, and that it was important for me to face what was going on in my life and step into that willingly. And I made that decision because a situation happened in 2009. I took a job at Wieden & Kennedy, an advertising agency in Portland, Oregon, after leaving being a flight attendant. And I went on a run with my dog after a really, really late night. It was about 4:30 in the morning. And I saw a man who's about 6'6" and a woman who was about my height, about 5 foot. I'm a shorty. And he was holding her with his left arm and punching her in the side with his right arm. And I didn't have a cell phone on me because we didn't usually carry cell phones around in 2009.
My goodness.
So I ran to a grocery store that was within running distance. And I asked for the security guard to call 911. And the security guard looked over my shoulder at the person who was being assaulted and said, oh, she's a prostitute. They're just going to arrest her anyway. And he kind of chuckled at me, turned around and walked away. So I yelled some expletives at the security guard, ran to my apartment to grab my cell phone. I called 911, ran back to the spot. By the time I got back, the woman was gone. And I can still, I work very, very hard not to remember her cries to this day. It's important that when these situations are happening, that we do not forget the most marginalized in our communities. I waited for the police to arrive. And when they did, I asked them, is this true that you would have arrested this person? And the police officers let me know that, yes, this is what would have happened. And I looked at them, and I didn't know very much about the police department at the time. And I said, I want to talk to your manager. And the police department, the police officers looked at me and they're like, we don't have managers, lady. But they ended up introducing me to lieutenants and captains. And within 2 weeks, actually, I was sitting across the way from Chief Rosie at the time, who was the chief of police of Multnomah County. And she gave me the best advice that I've ever gotten when it comes to this work. She told me, if you want to make any change, you need to get involved with grassroots nonprofits or work to change legislation. So I've dedicated my life to doing both. And I worked with a group of people to support them in passing a safe harbor law up in Oregon so that people were able to call the police when they were in situations where they were being harmed without fear of arrest. And I was really, really happy with that. But at the same time, as I was trying to get involved with different anti-trafficking organizations, I was realizing that they were helping people in far off lands. They were helping people in Thailand or in China or in Mexico. And I was like, trafficking is happening here. Who's helping the folks here? And there were some sex work organizations that I was able to get in touch with. Coyote Rhode Island, who's been doing work in New York for quite some time, or in Rhode Island rather, for quite some time. And they didn't really have any volunteer opportunities for me to get into where I was in Portland, Oregon. And the more I was connecting with people, the more I was understanding there's a lot of money going into anti-trafficking work, but there's not a lot of folks who are helping people in my city, in my town. And I got involved with the Cupcake Girls in February of 2012. The Cupcake Girls had been founded in February 2011, and they were just starting out. So I'm starting a year as a volunteer, a year after they had been founded. And I jumped in with both feet. The second that I understood the mission, the vision of the work that they were doing, they were providing absolutely non-judgmental advocacy to folks that are in the sex industry, as well as folks experiencing sex trafficking. They were partnering people with doctors and dentists and lawyers, and they were making sure that they had opportunities for pro bono access to these things.
Which is huge. That's so huge. Like, because there's so many, you know, instances where like the healthcare professional, that may be the only time that that person is not with their trafficker. Like that may be it. Like that is their only chance to like have that opportunity to ask that question. Do you feel safe? Or do you feel like you're in a situation where you're able to leave if you want to leave? Like, are you being held against your will? Like that's it. Like that's the only time when you're being cared for by a healthcare professional, because anonymity and you know, the reason why we do that is because we want people to be by themselves and we don't want them to be influenced by another person when they are discussing, you know, very intimate health related matters. Yes. And if that person is actively trafficking you, or if that person is abusing you, you don't want them to be in the room with you when you're having those kinds of conversations.
That is it. That is it. And it was really, really impactful to me. And as I was growing in the organization, like I said, I was a volunteer when I first started out. At first, I was just working 20 to 30 hours a week as a volunteer while I was doing my other job on the side. And then a few years passed, and the director of our Portland, Oregon branch actually stepped away from their position, and we were without leadership. And so I stepped into that role as director in our Oregon Southwest Washington branch. And I led that team for 6 years. And then we had more shifts within the organization. As we were in these seats and as we were within these roles, what kept happening was sex workers and trafficking survivors, they kept coming to us and saying, you know what? I'm needing you to provide me non-judgmental resources, because you're not. You're providing me resources, but they're not vetted well. You're sending me to people that are religious. And we actually had a pretty big Twitter thing happen in 2020 where folks were saying, you're doing a lot of fundraising, but I'm not seeing a lot of results happening in my life. And we were working on that and thinking through that, and leadership really got together and we were trying to understand, okay, how can we work better? How can we do better for this organization? And I think that's really a piece that I want to leave people with, is it's important to be remaining available, to be held accountable by the populations that you are attempting to serve. Because at the end of the day, if you're not willing to do that, you're in the wrong position. And I say that with a full heart. I think it's really important that we, as leaders, as helpers and healers, that we don't get stuck on our way of doing things, but we really think, what is best for the people that we're intending to serve? And we ask them and we listen to them and we make adjustments when necessary. And so anyway, I stepped into this role. I was asked to move out to Las Vegas to support our founder and CEO at the time in their role. And then a little bit after that, the CEO and founder had exited the organization and the board had asked me to step in as executive director of the organization. As soon as I stepped in as executive director, we made a lot of big changes that cost the organization quite a bit. We ended up taking a stance on the importance of decriminalizing sex work, the importance of understanding that we need to decriminalize sex work in order to create safety for sex workers and trafficking survivors. And that was through the understanding that we need to listen to the people that we're intending to serve. And so that's been a little tiny bit of my journey. And it's been really exciting to be able to be on this journey and learn more and grow more. But yes.
I am fully aware of where you are coming from. And I'm so excited for your allyship. And that's the other thing too. I think, you know, we talk a lot about how can we show up for each other? How can we show up to be more mindful, to be more present, to be able to impact the population, not just from a dollar standpoint, but from a representation standpoint.
That's
so
it.
How are we able to do that? And I know a lot of the clients that we see are either part of the queer community or part of the BIPOC community. And right. Like, one of the things that I absolutely adore about you is that, like, the first time I met you, we were like, white women, like, come on, people, like, you need to get together, excuse the language. But I was just like, so taken aback. But I was also like, holy crap, this is what we need. Like, we need somebody that is saying the quiet part out loud.
Yes.
We need somebody that is acknowledging that this is not okay. Like, we can't continue on this path and continue to sit in our privilege, right? Because that's what it is.
Right.
And pretend that we're not also part of the problem because we're not bringing it up and we're not talking about it and we're not being realistic about how our choices impact others.
That's it. And I talk a lot about how, you know, it's important that as white women, when we are making that stance, that it's understood I'm a part of that population. I'm not separating myself from that. I am one of the white women that is the problem. And so we need to work on being anti-racist, but saying out loud the quiet part. We need to actively be working to define what's wrong and then work to defeat it, because you cannot defeat what you are unwilling to define. And I talk a lot about the root causes of trafficking are capitalism, colonialism, racism, and the patriarchy. And we are not talking about those things. We're not talking about the ways that we need to be dismantling those foundational structures that are literally killing us. They're killing all of us. And so as we work to define these things, we will be able to defeat them. But if we keep putting band-aids on things and hoping that they'll go away, we're not going to be making any movement.
Yeah. And again, I know that we've kind of talked a little bit about your mission and your vision for the organization, but you talked about WHO. I want to talk about NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health. So they declared sexually transmitted infections a public health crisis in 2018. It is continuing to be a challenge. And we are now seeing this not only impacting the individual, but also impacting newborn children. So we're, you know, astronomical rates of congenital syphilis, and it just keeps continuing to happen. And so now you're seeing concepts like DoxyPep, which is like giving people, you know, a medication after a sexual encounter in order to prevent them from getting chlamydia, gonorrhea, or syphilis. Right. We would never even have thought about that even just 5 years ago. Right. And, you know, we're pushing HIV prevention as well. But I'm just curious, obviously your non-judgmental advocacy work, as well as trauma-informed care, is getting at the heart of what the needs of the sex workers are and those who are trafficked. But how do you see that aligning with sort of those public health goals? Because again, we can do a lot to help them with like housing and food and all of those things, but we also have to worry about their health. And if they are engaging in sex work, how is that contributing potentially, if we're not getting them the protection that they need, to the rate of transmission of all of these infections? So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about that alignment? And is that something that you guys actively talk about as part of your like non-judgmental service line?
100%. So at the Cupcake Girls, we understand sex work is work. It's a job like any other job. And I want to make sure before we continue in this conversation, there are differences between sex workers and sex trafficked folks. So people that are sex trafficked, they are forced, coerced, or manipulated into trafficking. People that are sex workers, they are consenting into this work. They are understanding that it's the job that they are using. It's the job that they are doing. Now, it is a job unlike any other job, but there are similarities. Sometimes do you like doing your job? Yes. Sometimes do you not like doing your job? Yes. Sometimes have you had jobs that have been toxic, that have been dangerous, that you have needed to get out of, but you've had to stay in order to make sure that you have enough money to get to the next job? Yes. So it's important to understand it's a job and it's how people are taking care of themselves and their families. So before we even move forward, it's important to clarify those two items. That being said, our government does not clarify those two items. And because of that, what is actively happening is we have a misunderstanding about what is sex work, what is sex trafficking, and we are actively criminalizing both. So we're criminalizing sex workers, we're criminalizing sex trafficking survivors. Even in this state, in the state that we're sitting in right now in Nevada, we are actively arresting folks who are being trafficked. This is a problem. It's a huge problem.
We are re-victimizing, we are re-traumatizing every time that happens. And then obviously we started off this conversation with the work that you were talking about with the law enforcement folks actually being part of the perpetrators, not 100%. Even the solution. Right. Which we know happens way more than it should.
And unfortunately, yes. And I think that like, as we're having these conversations, we have to set this up well. We have to be talking about who the folks are that we're talking about, because many people don't understand the difference. And so we've set that stage. We both have an understanding. There we go. Now, the next piece is when we're criminalizing something, we make it unsafe, period. When we're criminalizing something, we make it unsafe. And I'm going to tell you why that is. People do not have access to the care that they need and that they deserve, either by implicit or explicit bias. And I'm going to tell you what that looks like. You talked about how healthcare professionals, they often are needing to have a quiet space where they can talk to somebody about their health. What if your healthcare professional in the past has raped you because they recognized you from a previous porn you were in and they considered your presence to be conditional consent? What about your healthcare professional then? Because that's the story that I hear constantly from my program participants. What about when people are going to try to have a safe
space? Wait, before we move on to that, I just want to like highlight the fact that you said program participants. So there's also, that's also a very intentional language that you're using because of the potential for stigmatization. And so I just want to like recognize that and affirm that, because I do think that that's really important, because the way that we use language and the way that we communicate about things impacts whether or not people are going to take your help, right? Because here's the thing, I may tell you that I can come in and be your savior, but maybe you don't want me to be your savior, right? Like, how about we ask permission first, you know?
And are you in the right seat to be saving anybody?
Correct.
Are you in the right seat to be saving anybody? Who are you to be a savior? We are not here to save anybody. We are simply here to address the need, which is people do not have access to safe resources. That's it. We are here to be an access to safe resources. We are here to vet those resources, make sure that people have access to not be raped when they go to the dentist, to not be raped when they take their kids to the pediatrician, to not be raped when they go to a lawyer. We want access to safe services, safe resources. So alongside my story about the healthcare professionals, when we have program participants that are trying to achieve healthcare, when they're trying to get access to, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, PEP and PrEP and getting access to checking to make sure that they don't have gonorrhea, to make sure that they don't have syphilis, to make sure they don't have chlamydia in between their client interactions, right? And to be able to access healthcare if they do have those things. If you're scared to go to a doctor because you need to go frequently because of the line of work you do, that doctor is going to out you as a sex worker and potentially call the police on you, which happens all the time. Will you go to that healthcare professional? Absolutely not. Us criminalizing sex work is actively killing people. It is that needs to change. And that's something that I talk about all the time. Thankfully, the Cupcake Girls has access to safe and healthy resources, much like yourself, where we're able to give people access to be checking themselves, to make sure that they're free of disease, to make sure that they're free of virus before they go on to the next person and have their next client. But when we are criminalizing this, not only are we making healthcare access really, really hard to come by, but we're also making safe clients for our participants to access hard to come by. Because when we're criminalizing something, what happens? You have to-
It goes underground.
That's it.
And it doesn't go away. It just goes in the black market and it becomes more dangerous.
That's it. And who are the main people who are being arrested for sex work? And who are the main people who are being pimped, who are being trafficked? Indigenous women and Black women. Yep. And why is that? Racism. We talk to judges all the time that are telling us it's an issue where people are pimping out Black women and Indigenous women because they know they will receive a lighter sentence rather than if they were to pimp out a white woman. And I am not saying, and I did not say, that white women are not also survivors of trafficking or people that are being trafficked. I want to be clear about that, because a lot of the time when I talk about race and racial bias, a lot of white women will come up and they'll say, but I'm also in this situation. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the percentage of people that are Black and that are Indigenous are being trafficked at a ridiculous rate. And it's something that we're not talking about. We don't want to talk about it. It makes us uncomfortable, but we cannot defeat what we are unwilling to define. And so it's important that we talk about racial bias in our systems, in our legal systems, in our prison industrial complex, in our healthcare complexes, and the nonprofit industrial complex, which I'm a part of. It's important that we talk about these biases so that we can crush them.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you're a fierce advocate for just gender-based health and gender-based rights, but as a pharmacist and a healthcare professional, what are things that you would tell us that we can do to inform ourselves to make us a better resource for your clients, for your program participants, if we were in a situation where we were able to provide them with services?
Yeah, I think one of the main things is when folks are coming to you for assistance within gynecological health, sexual health, not judging and not asking too many questions is your best bet, because you want to stay away from or stray away from any implicit or explicit bias. You are here to do no harm. That is why you're here. You need to remember that. This story of the participant or the client or the patient who's sitting in front of you, whatever term you use, their life is in their hands. You are simply the conduit for them to be able to receive a safe resource. That is it. It's important that you listen to the people that are sitting in front of you and really check yourself to make sure that you are not perpetuating bias onto them, intentionally or unintentionally. And that looks like reading a lot of books. There are many, many books about sexual health, sexual freedom, reproductive rights. Also, being an advocate for abortion services is really, really important. When we're talking about the ways that people get trapped in these trafficking situations, almost always we're looking at pimps that are trying to get the people that they're trafficking pregnant. We need to make sure that folks have access to safe abortions. Cupcake Girls currently hands out Julie, which is an abortion pill that we will give to people absolutely free of charge at our free store. It is always available. We'll give people as many as they need and is with no questions asked. It's important that we're fierce advocates for abortion health. It's also important that we're fierce advocates for HIV prevention. We need to be talking about PEP. We need to be talking about PrEP. And we need to be making sure that people know the difference. We have a lot of people, as you were mentioning, in the LGBTQIA plus community that may have gone through, you know, gender affirming services. So if you were born female, you're going to be taking different HIV prevention tools than if you're born male. And we need to be talking about that, giving people all of the access to all of their healthcare and not gatekeeping the healthcare and not assuming that we are the savior, but understanding that we are the conduit to resources. We all need to be looking at each other as human, and we all need to be understanding that each of us as individuals are the best people to decide for our own bodies what we need to be doing with our own bodies and our own situations. I would not ever say, you know what, Christina, I know the best thing for you and your health and mental health. Here's the plan for your life. Go, you got this. And why would I never do that? It wouldn't work.
Yeah, because you have a different lived experience than I do.
There you go.
And you can empathize with people, but I really dislike the term like live a life in someone else's shoes. Like I dislike that because I don't know what it's like to live a day in your life. Right. And I should never assume any part of that. But what I can do is tell you that I woke up Black today and I know that discrimination is real. And I may not live, you know, I don't have the same lived experience as a gay male. I don't have the same lived experience as a trans woman, but I know what it's like to be discriminated against. I know what it's like to experience stigma and racism and discrimination. And so I can at least bring that to the table and lead with compassion and care.
And integrity,
but without putting myself on you. Like that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to, you know, scrutinize your choices. Like that's not what I'm here for. What I'm here for is, like you said, to provide you with safe access to care. Yeah. And I really like this sort of like the simplification of that. Because when you start seeing people, you know, regardless of whether or not you agree with someone's choices, that doesn't mean that they're undeserving of your care and compassion. Because that's the other thing too, regardless of whether or not you personally would seek abortion care, that doesn't mean that you should deny abortion care to someone. Whether or not you think that having multiple partners or engaging in sex work is something that you would personally do, doesn't mean that you should tell someone else that they can't do it. Because that's their own life, that's their own lived experience, and that's their choice. And you need to respect their choice without judging their choice.
Right. 100%. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, I appreciate that. I know we are coming at the end of our interview. This was so wonderful. I appreciate you so much on so many levels. You know, question that I often ask my guests, just because we are all works in progress and we've all gotten to certain places in our lives. And like you said, you know, this is a calling. And I always say, you know, you never know who needs to hear what you have to say. And you're always in the right place at the right time. So always speak up, always say your truth. And be intentional, because you never know. You never know who's listening. Yes. So with that being said, if you were able to give advice to your younger self, what would it be and why?
If I were to give advice to my younger self, I would tell her to take a minute and really think about what non-judgment really means. Because I think for a really, really long time, even in my work at the Cupcake Girls, and as an organization too, I think we had an idea of what that meant and what that looked like, but I wish I would have sat a little bit more and listened a little bit more and really took stock of my own biases, whether implicit or explicit. I wish I would have done a little bit more work. I wish I would have moved a little bit slower and listened a little bit more. I think that's what I would tell me.
Yeah. And how freaking kick butt awesome you are right now.
I mean, that's definitely a piece too. I think that, like, as you know, women in our society, we are often told about all the things that we're not. And I probably would have sat myself down and say something like, you are worthy, you are important, your life matters, you are enough. Probably would have done a lot of that too.
But yes, a lot of the affirmation.
Yeah. Definitely focusing on that bias, I think, is so important.
Yes. So just to kind of like, let people know, where can they find you? Where can your organization, you know, if people want to find out like what's going on, I know you guys have some exciting things that are going to be announced pretty soon. Yeah. Would love to like just get some of that information in the show notes if we want to just kind of close out with that.
Absolutely. So please reach out to us at www.thecupcakegirls.org. You'll find a lot of information about who we are and what we do on our website, as well as links to support if you're needing those. You can also find us on TikTok, Twitter, or is it now called X?
And it's X now.
Instagram. And our handle is @cupcakegirls.org.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Amy. Again, you're an incredible human being. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And I hope that our, you know, individuals who are listening to this or viewing this episode take away the fact that we can just all do better to be able to provide culturally competent and compassionate care to everyone that's judgment-free. And really, you know, when we think about why we went into healthcare, it's to do no harm. So again, thank you so much. And I look forward to continuing to work with you. And I am just so appreciative of the advocacy work you do. So thank you so much. And again, you are strong, you are wonderful, you are capable, you are enough. And if anybody else needed to hear that today, girl, you amazing.
So I love
it. End with that. Again, my name is Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. I am your host. And remember, public health matters.
Are you curious about the compensation of pharmacists in other work environments or even other areas of the country? What about their job satisfaction levels? So are we. Head to the link in the description to take this year's Pharmacy Times Salary and Job Satisfaction Survey, featuring new questions about burnout and the future of pharmacy. Thank you.